From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Life doesn't always provide second chances. That's what musical comedy is for. That's good news for one man who couldn't beat the Yankees, ex-Red Sox general manager Dan Duquette. We'll hear him sing. Mercy. And we'll return to the golfing days when high-tech meant fly screens on the windows of the clubhouse. Also coming up on Only a Game, Tim Kirkjian on the latest shuffling of ballplayers who may make all the difference in New York, Boston, or San Francisco. And U.S. fans of international soccer get a chance to watch stars like Ronaldinho without leaving home.
I got to touch him, and I can't wash my right hand now. I'll never wash it. He is gorgeous.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. Uday and Qusay Hussein, the sons of ousted Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, have been buried in the family cemetery. We get more from NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad.
Saddam Hussein's two sons, Uday and Qusay, were buried today after the U.S. military announced that their bodies were handed over to the Iraqi Red Crescent Society. Eyewitnesses say the corpses were wrapped in Iraqi flags and that the ceremony took place in the presence of a large American military force. The bodies were buried in Saddam's hometown of Tikrit, nearly 2 weeks after the two brothers were killed in battle against American forces. That is not in line with Islamic tradition, where the dead are usually buried on the same day that the person passes away. The town of Tikrit, meanwhile, has been the site of almost daily raids by American forces, with U.S. military spokesmen announcing that close associates of Saddam Hussein are being captured there on almost a daily basis.
NPR's Ivan Watson reporting from Baghdad. A U.S. soldier was killed late last night and three others were wounded in a grenade attack on a military convoy just outside Baghdad. The unidentified soldier is the 52nd serviceman to die in combat in Iraq since President Bush declared major combat over on May 1st. The military also announced today that U.S. soldiers fired in self-defense and killed a woman yesterday. It happened near the site of an attack on U.S. soldiers when an explosive was dropped from an overpass onto a U.S. convoy. The U.N. Security Council has approved a multinational force of peacekeepers for Liberia. In the meantime, West African peacekeepers will try for a second day to meet with Liberian President Charles Taylor to urge him to go into exile, as he has repeatedly vowed to do in the past. The BBC's Paul Welsh reports from Monrovia.
President Taylor can't have expected that the ministers who came to see him would stick it out and stay the night in this city, which has been bombarded and fought over for 13 days now. But they're determined, they're still here, and they're promised a meeting shortly. The president stood the ministers up, saying he wasn't in the capital, that he was directing the battle to regain the second city in the east of the country. They'll have their suspicions. No one saw him leave Monrovia, and his loyal press corps, who follow his every move, spent the day outside his house, waiting for him to come out. If it comes, the meeting is likely to be brief. Confirmation that the peacekeepers will come on Monday, and a new assurance that Charles Taylor will leave as promised shortly after the deployment begins.
The BBC's Paul Welsh reporting. North Korea is warning that any moves to discuss Pyongyang's suspected nuclear weapons program at the UN would be considered just short of a prelude to war. The warning comes one day after the communist nation agreed to hold multilateral talks on that issue. You're listening to NPR News. San Diego fire officials are calling an overnight blaze that destroyed a five-story apartment complex an incident of domestic terrorism. Eric Anderson of member station KPBS in San Diego reports.
The fire completely destroyed an apartment building complex that was under construction in the University City neighborhood. San Diego fire officials say they believe the blaze was deliberately set. When firefighters arrived on the scene, they found the complex completely consumed by flames. Nearby was a large banner that read, "If you build it, we will burn it." The initials ELF were also found. Authorities say that could connect the fire to the Earth Liberation Front, a loosely knit group that advocates the use of economic sabotage to protect the planet. They're known to oppose urban sprawl and have been linked to fire since 1997. San Diego police, the FBI, and arson experts are investigating the blaze. The fire caused $20 million worth of damage. For NPR News, I'm Eric Anderson in San Diego.
Firefighters in Montana are trying to hold back a large wildfire threatening homes in the Glacier National Park. Fire crews yesterday worked to extend a 7-mile barrier they burned earlier this week to remove dry brush and timber ahead of the main fire and to keep it from reaching West Glacier and the park's headquarters. Residents along Blakemanship Road were evacuated before yesterday's burnout began. The fire is one of three that have blackened more than 60,000 acres along the western edge of the park. Wildfires forced nearly 7,500 people in British Columbia to evacuate their homes last night. At least 60 homes were destroyed by the fire in the town of Barrier, according to emergency officials. The government of British Columbia has declared a state of emergency for the area. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Atlanta Braves are the only team to have won more than 70 games already. The Braves and the San Francisco Giants have the biggest leads among the six teams currently in first place. And the recently disgraced, corked bat-wielding Sammy Sosa put ignominy behind him and led the major leagues in home runs during the month of July. ESPN's Tim Kirkjian knew all that already, and he joins me now to discuss various other developments at various ballyards. Hello, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. Now, Tim, the New York Yankees added yet another all-star to their lineup before the trading deadline. Third baseman Aaron Boone, formerly of the Cincinnati Reds, joins the team. Does that and the acquisitions of relief pitchers Armando Benitez and Gabe White give the Yankees a lock?
I think it locks them into the playoffs. I don't think it locks them beyond that. I think they're going to win the division. I think they're going to the postseason. But the American League is a very interesting league. I still don't think there's a dominant team in that league or the National League. And I still don't think the Yankees have locked anything up now except for a pretty clear course to the playoffs. Aaron Boone's a very good player. I didn't think they needed a third baseman, but they got him anyway, typical of the Yankees. Now they need to find a right fielder to play every day, which I'm sure they'll find before the playoff rosters are set on August 31st. So they're just trying to win, and they're trying to hold off the Red Sox, who are doing a pretty good job trying to keep up with them in the in the race for arms and to improve their club.
Well, that was, of course, going to be my next question. How much have the Red Sox improved themselves? Part of what they've done is reacquire some guys that they used to have.
Well, I talked to a general manager yesterday, and I asked him, give me your number one thought about the trading deadline. And he said, Theo Epstein is great. That was the first thing he said. So these relief pitchers that Theo Epstein and starting pitchers has acquired in the last week have really made the Red Sox a demonstrably better pitching staff than they had 2 weeks ago. And in Scott Sauerbeck, they added a lefty. In Jeff Suppan, they added a guy to the rotation. In Scott Williamson, they added the best guy on the Cincinnati Reds pitching staff, a guy who can strike people out in the seventh and eighth innings. And now a team that had the most disastrous bullpen for about 2 months has a chance to have one of the best bullpens in the league.
The San Francisco Giants, with what looks like an insurmountable lead in the National League West, picked up a pitcher, Sidney Ponson, the best baseball player to hail from Aruba, as I understand it. Does this put the Giants in the World Series?
Well, it certainly gets them to the playoffs, which I think they were going anyway, but they got Sidney Ponson to win the World Series. They are going to rent this guy for 2 months. That's it. They know he's a free agent after the season. They know they're not going to be able to re-sign him, and they know they gave up three pitchers to get him, two of whom have a chance to be very good major league pitchers before long. So they really took a chance on this, but I love teams who will overpay and take a big risk on a guy thinking, what if he's great? What if he pitches this way the rest of the season? We might win the World Series. Earl Weaver used to tell me all the time, when you have a chance to win the World Series, you have to go for it now. Then you figure out next year.
The Kansas City Royals, usually at this time of year, are holding fire sales and getting rid of contracts, but they're in first place. They've held on to some star players. Does this mean the Royals are actually trying to build a contender not only this year but on down the line?
Yes, they are, Bill, and I know you love it when I tell you how wrong I've been during the course of a season. The Royals, I have been wrong for every step of the way. I thought they would lose 100 games again this year. Then they started out like 18-3. Then they were in first place by so much, and I said, this will never last. They hit a terrible streak, and I said, they'll never come back. Then they came back and built a 6.5-game lead, and then I said, all right, they're going to win the division now, and now their lead is down to one game. So now I don't think they're going to win the division. I have waffled back and forth 4 times on the Royals this year. I've been wrong every step of the way. The bottom line is they are a contending team. They're demonstrably better than anybody thought they would be this year, and they've got something going long-term whether they make the playoffs this year or not.
Tim, are there any other teams that we haven't mentioned that have really benefited from this latest flurry of trades and that may find that the second half of the season or the last 2 months of the season is greatly improved as a result?
Well, I think we've covered the teams that really, really improved themselves. I think it's more interesting, Bill, the teams that didn't do anything, including the Houston Astros, who are worried about their ace, Roy Oswalt, who is hurt and may be hurt for quite a while longer. The Cardinals desperately needed to add another starting pitcher, and they didn't get anybody at the trading deadline. And this is where all GMs earn their money. Do they have the courage to pull the trigger and make a big trade? In the Cardinals' case, they were not willing to trade J.D. Drew, one of their really good young outfielders, and the Astros just weren't willing to make a deal for one of their relievers. They figured they'd keep them all. Now we'll see, because usually a big trade that's made at the trading deadline, you can go back to that and say that's how the team got into the playoffs, or maybe the team that didn't do anything, that's why they didn't get to the playoffs.
Tim Kirchton covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine, and he's our baseball analyst here at Only a Game. Tim, thanks again.
Okay, Bill, thank you.
The representation of baseball in movies and plays has not been entirely successful, in part because the casting has too often been unconvincing. A current production of Damn Yankees is attempting to address this problem by grafting life onto art. Only a Game's Pippin Ross has our report.
Wacona Park in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, is one of the oldest minor league ball fields in the country and home to the independent Northeast League's Black Bears. But a different kind of entertainment is taking place on the field this week, a production of the 1950s musical Damn Yankees, starring former Red Sox general manager Dan Duquette.
The title of the play is very attractive. The storyline of Damn Yankees is a terrific storyline. I mean, people, you know, throughout the years and throughout baseball have sold varying parts of their soul to the devil to try to beat the Damn Yankees, if you will, for many years.
Something the man knows well, Duquette was trashed by Red Sox fans and ultimately fired because the Red Sox couldn't beat the Yankees. It was Duquette who cut loose power pitcher Roger Clemens, who eventually collected a couple of World Series rings for, well, the Damn Yankees.
We don't play the rest, of course.
Art is certainly imitating life in Duquette's professional acting debut as Benny Van Buren, the general manager of the fictional Washington Senators, who are led by a player who sells his soul to the devil to beat the Yankees. The idea to stage the production in the park where Duquette, as a kid, caught his first foul ball came from Jenny Hirsch, the 40-year-old part owner of the Black Bears, plays bass in the production. She and her husband are paying for Damn Yankees to the tune of several hundred thousand dollars.
I actually just thought it would be fun. And as, you know, I enlisted Dan Duquette, the next person was James Warwick, the director. He brought me to the Colonial Theater and Susan Sperber. Then slowly this incredible creative team, an incredible production team, most with Berkshire connections, was gathered. And I told them all, each person that I met who signed on, I said, let's really have fun.
The show's proceeds will go toward the restoration of the nearby Colonial Theater, a now decrepit turn-of-the-century venue that once hosted John and Ethel Barrymore and the Ziegfeld Follies.
Baseball is only one half skill. The other half
is something else. Something bigger. You gotta have pot. All you really need is pot. You'll never win. That's when they grin.
Duquette's theatrical adventure is bolstered by a troupe of Broadway professionals. Director James Warwick admits he was reluctant to put a rookie in the lead, but he's been impressed by Duquette's clutch performance.
I don't think Dan Duquette is ever going to play Hamlet, but his level of expertise has exceeded my expectations. It really has. He's opened up as a human being. It's like a wonderful kind of therapy session in front of everybody's eyes in rehearsal.
Perhaps he's exploring his inner general manager. Duquette says he's found lots of similarities between sports and theater.
There's a lot of teamwork. They're both in the entertainment business, and the actors are individual performers, but when they work together, it makes for a much better product.
The difference, Duquette says, there's a lot less ego in theater. Actor Seth Malkin says he's been surprised by Duquette's humility and his skill at helping these veteran thespians look and act like ball players. The dirt on Duquette's technique?
He clearly goes home and works, I think, in the mirror.
Maybe that's to get a chance to see what he looks like, saying something Duquette never said to his numerous critics, who characterized him as cold, aloof, even wooden.
You gotta have heart. All you really need is heart. When the odds are saying you'll never win.
So, is all this singing and dancing better than baseball?
You gotta have heart.
I don't think it's a career change, but it's a lot of fun to come out and see damn Yankees at Wacona Park at dusk, you know, during baseball season. I mean, what's better than that? Beating the Yankees, I guess.
Though Dan Duquette says he'd welcome the opportunity to help some nonfiction team beat the Yankees and everyone else, he may not be home when the phone rings. Producer Jenny Hirsch says she's considering taking damn Yankees on the road. For Only a Game, I'm Pippin Ross in Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
A great pitcher we haven't got. A great ball club we haven't got. What have we got?
It's 18 minutes past the hour.
Fly me to the moon.
Karaoke experts in Japan and in the other Asian nations where making a fool of yourself by singing along to a music track is considered excellent fun claim there is no tradition of karaoke competition. That's perhaps why Asians did not participate in the bar singing fest in Finland this summer, and it may explain why Danny Gadby, a British restaurant worker, won the inaugural World Karaoke Championship. It's a victory Mr. Gadby may have little reason to treasure, according to Thomas Heinonen, a music producer from Sweden who helped judge the competition. It's a bunch of music star wannabes, said Heinonen, perhaps rendered grumpy by witnessing off-key renditions of Fly Me to the Moon all night long.
Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. Serena Williams, the top-ranked women's tennis player in the world, announced she will not play in the U.S. Open later this month. Williams underwent knee surgery yesterday and will be out of action for 6 to 8 weeks. In American League Baseball, the Baltimore Orioles edged the Boston Red Sox 2-1. The Oakland Athletics squeaked by the New York Yankees 3-2 in 10 innings. The Minnesota Twins throttled the Detroit Tigers 10-4. The Tampa Bay Devil Rays bested the Kansas City Royals 9-6. And the Chicago White Sox shellacked the Seattle Mariners 12-1. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce on the game U.S. citizens know as football. But first...
Domenico! Go!
Last Saturday at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts, when two of the world's most accomplished soccer teams, Juventus of Italy and FC Barcelona of Spain, were practicing for a game to be held the following day, the folks in attendance were a colorful, multilingual lot. The matchup, a friendly, was part of a string of games called the Champions World Series, being played in seven different venues across the U.S., featuring not only Juve and Barca, but Manchester United, AC Milan, and several other top professional clubs from around the world. On Saturday in Foxborough, Carmine Capone and Larry Doucette, dressed in the distinctive black and white stripes of their favorite team, celebrated their good fortune.
Well, I'm Italian. My parents are from Italy. And I've always watched them play on TV, and I just, you know, I fell in love with the team. They're unbelievable.
No so what's kind of, how does your dream play out? You've got your Juventus jersey. You get some people over here shaking hands, some players, some coaches saying, hey, thanks for wearing the colors.
I'd love that. Awesome. That would be like the, I wouldn't have need anything else in my life right there.
That'd be so awesome.
I mean, came here all the way down here just to see these guys play. It's unbelievable.
All the way down here, in Carmine Capone's case, only meant about 20 miles. He lives in Boston. Some of the Barcelona fans had endured considerably longer trips to see the team they adore. Gary and Don Parisio, for example.
Well, first off, I'm half Catalan, so Barcelona is one of my favorite teams, of course. Well, the favorite team. And it's part of my heritage. And we go to Spain every once in a while, and we see the games there. So when it was close to us in the United States, we just couldn't help but be here.
And how close was close in this case?
About a five-hour drive upstate New York.
And we're here for number 10.
Number 10.
What's his name?
Ronaldinho.
Yeah, there he is.
He'll be here.
The opportunity to watch the two teams practice came with the price of a game ticket. And for folks like the Parisios, or for three guys named Pablo, Gaston, and Benedetto, who'd driven to Foxborough from Toronto, it was a significant bonus. Though Pablo, a Barca fan, recognized that actually sitting with Benedetto, a Juve fan, during the game might be risky.
I'm going to be a hurricane of teeth and nails if a Juventus scores and I got to hear him cheering for them, but, you know, we'll see.
We're probably better off sitting opposite sides of the stadium.
For us, the friendship to drive home might be a little tense.
It's a long drive.
In the parking lot of the stadium the next day, 2 hours before game time, lots of the same fans who'd watched the practices were tailgating. The Barca theme song poured out of the tape player in Gary and Don Parisio's car as they celebrated how well things had gone after the previous day's practice.
The whole Barcelona team came over and signed autographs and talked to the fans. They were fantastic.
Terrific. So which autographs did you end up getting?
I got Quaresma, Saviola, and Ronaldinho.
Ronaldinho
three
was
times.
There, ready to go. Terrific.
He made it to the practice. He made it to the practice.
And I can't wash my right hand. I got to touch. Oh, what's his name? The new number 10.
Ronaldinho?
Yes, I got to touch him, and I can't wash my right hand now. I'll never wash it. He is gorgeous. Love his hair.
Across the parking lot, Fred DiCenzo was no less passionate about the other team.
Okay, I've been a Juventus fan from when I was 4 years old, back in Italy. We have a Juventus club in Boston that we have like 55, 60 members. And we pick up all the games of the Juventus team from Europe. You know, Juventus has been the dominant team for years and years. I was going to Italy for vacation. I postponed it so that I could come and watch this game. What happened is when you're a kid, and obviously the team that is winning the most, you follow, right?
And everybody be Yankees fans. What do you mean?
But that's what happened. We were a group over in Italy that time. We're all following Juventus team. At the time, she was one of the greatest team. Winning or losing, we stuck with the same team all the time. And even though this year we didn't win the European Cup, we gave it a good run.
You've been crying ever since.
Yeah.
As far as the game itself was concerned, both coaches had warned the press, the fans, and perhaps each other not to expect brilliant soccer. Juventus and Barcelona are essentially in training camp, preparing for their regular seasons. Still, there were moments of rare footballing art, especially from Niederlander midfielder Edgar Davids in the first half, as Juventus did everything but score. At the other end, Javier Saviola demonstrated mid-season form, at least as far as finding the seams in the Juve defense was concerned, scoring twice. Saviola's success led at least one Barca fan to call for more appreciation from the crowd.
It's not a tennis match, it's a soccer match. That's what I don't understand this crowd. There you go, see? You, this is a soccer crowd, but everybody's shut down. I don't know what's going on. I come from South America. The game is shout, just trying to share a team, you know, just that's all it's about, it, you know.
Perhaps because there was too little shouting from the Barca fans, Juventus scored twice late in the second half to tie the game, which was ultimately decided by Barcelona's 6-5 edge in penalty kicks. The result was finally much less important than the opportunity for fans living in the Boston area and those willing to drive a long way to get there to see some of the game's greatest players in action. Frank Rijkaard, the accomplished Dutch former player who recently took over as Barcelona's coach, recognized the significance of that function of the friendly match in the post-game press conference when a reporter asked him if he'd been happy with Ronaldinho's performance in his first game for Barca.
He did a great job for our team. And I think that we can be very satisfied. And you see that when he touched the ball, that he has something special. And you can also see that he is a player who's always happy to play. And I think that's a wonderful thing for our team, because that's something that we need. We have to realize that work is real serious, but playing is also fun. And if we can do that with talent and the right mentality, we can get somewhere.
Informed moments later that his coach had appreciated the way he seemed to be enjoying himself on the pitch, Ronaldinho shrugged as if to suggest that it could not be otherwise.
Yes, I'm a happy person, and I like to bring my joy and my happiness to the field.
Tomorrow evening, the Champions World Series of exhibition matches will continue when Manchester United and Barcelona will attempt to bring joy and happiness to the field in Philadelphia. Joining me now to discuss the Champions World Series and other soccer matters is our analyst, Seamus Mallon. Hello, Seamus.
Hi, Bill.
I'm sure you saw at least some of these games. I know nobody was supposed to be in top form during this tour. It is preseason, but I was thoroughly impressed. How about you?
I was quite impressed, perhaps in a selective way. I was impressed by Barcelona, frankly, more than anybody else, because their season does not begin until the end of August, as is the case for the Italian teams. Mm-hmm. I was less surprised by Manchester United because, in fact, they kick off for real August 10th, or that first weekend in August with one match, and then the league starts a week later. So they are really far ahead of the other teams, and they showed it in the way they've been playing. So they were massively impressive.
Tomorrow, AC Milan plays Juventus in the Meadowlands. Is there any such thing as an exhibition match between these two teams? I know it's not a league match.
Well, at the Super Cup, it's called. That many people felt that the European Championship game last May was the Stupor Cup. And hopefully this will not be the case. It's likely to be a good match because neither side is really fully fit, of course, as we saw the other night when Juventus were roundly routed by Manchester United. Mm-hmm. But that means there'll be a lot of space to play in. It's different to cover up the space. It'll be difficult for them to sort of defensively kill off the game. So there should be some good goals. There should be some good action. And frankly, it's not that big a deal as a trophy. So even though Juventus will be out to do a lot better than they did against Manchester United and against Milan in the Cup, the European Cup final, it's not that big a deal.
When I asked the communications director of Juventus whether this series might inspire more enthusiasm for the game here in the U.S., he shrugged. He said, probably not. Do you agree?
Well, it's a big question that's always raised about big international events here. It was raised about World Cup 94, and it was the impetus in the end to start MLS, no question, 2 years later. I think you have to recognize that the audience that these games cater to is an evolving audience now. It used to be very much only sort of the first generations or the ethnic population, but now more and more you begin to see what you would call a sort of the new American soccer fans coming out of the suburbs, beginning to wear replica shirts and going to watch these games. That's a bit of a change, but whether or not it foretells a huge manifestation of support for MLS, that really is another matter altogether.
Seamus, let's talk a little bit about Major League Soccer at the All-Star break. The defending champion Los Angeles Galaxy have not rallied much, even with the opportunity to finally play some home games as the season has gone on. Their home, however, has become something of a focal point.
It is. It's a fantastic stadium. I was there to see a game recently, and it is as close as I have seen in the United States to a genuine, if you will, European football stadium, a soccer stadium from Europe. They took the advice of Jurgen Klinsmann, the great former German national team player who's settled now in Los Angeles, to put a roof on.
Mm-hmm.
And that keeps the sound inside. So the capacity being 27,000, 15,000 can sound like 30,000. And it's much more of a feel for Europe. L.A., on the other hand, has struggled to take advantage of this home field. As you mentioned, they played so many matches, 8 away from home. Then they had to go to Korea for another tournament or to the Far East for another tournament. Now they've got the second half of the year to pull their socks up and start to play better. Their coach has been quite disappointed with the style of play so far at home.
Chicago, New York, and San Jose would seem to be the favorites at this point in a very bunched group of teams. Which of those three do you like?
Well, it's early days, of course. San Jose, I think, has the wonderful Landon Donovan, who's a match winner on his own. Now, as for New York, the Metro Stars have lost their tremendous goalkeeper, Tim Howard, off to Manchester United, where he had a remarkable performance in his first game. Meanwhile, they have signed this new goalkeeper, an American named Walker, who comes from, of all places, the Colo-Colo club in Santiago in Chile,
mm-hmm.
where he's been laboring for 7 or 8 years. And he is delighted to be in New York. So he, I think, as opposed to Landon Donovan for San Jose, could be the difference to keep them in the hunt right down to the end. So I somehow think New York and San Jose could be there at the final.
This afternoon in Carson, California, in the aforementioned Home Depot Center, home of the Galaxy, the MLS All-Stars will play the Mexican club team, Chivas de Guadalajara. The folks who run MLS seem to like experimenting with their All-Star game formats. Is there any precedent for this particular experiment?
No, but I'd suggest one more experiment, and that is forget it. Forget the All-Star game. Do away with it. It's a nonsense. It's an abomination. It's kind of an embarrassment from time to time. But it is such a part of the American landscape that it's irresistible. If you do away with it, you're essentially saying we're foreign, and that's why they have to do it. The sponsors love it. But the actual contest itself turns out to, in many ways, represent the worst of All-Star games. This one is a little quirky, and it might very well be more fun because Chivas de Guadalajara is a very proud club, has tremendous support in North America from the Mexican immigrant community,
mm-hmm.
and would be a very, very good test for the best of the MLS All-Stars. But you can't blame these players for MLS if they sort of treat it as a time for a little bit of a break. And whether they will rise competitively to the situation against an international side, I don't know. But what I would like to see more of, frankly, is teams from other countries coming to play the best of MLS, not the All-Star team, because that's a non-existent team, but the other teams. Manchester United come and play Juventus, great, but I'd really rather see them play Kansas City.
Sure.
I mean, that's what MLS needs to do. They need to test themselves in good, rigorous preseason matches for European side where something of pride and performance is on the line.
Seamus, we ought to talk a little bit about the upcoming Women's World Cup, or at least somebody ought to talk about it. Where are the funny TV ads with everybody at the dentist saying, I want what Mia's getting, pull out some of my teeth,
right.
You know, fill some of my cavities. I'm not hearing much, and it's only a little over 7 weeks away.
Well, it is the side product of the brief preparation time allowed by the Americans taking over this tournament. I mean, the one in 99, they had 3.5, 4 years to get ready. Plenty of time to make clever commercials, plenty of time to build support for exciting American women. who were, in, if you remember, 4 years ago, playing only for the national team. There was no league. Now these women are scattered across 8 franchises in the United States, having to play professionally for their teams, trying to make the playoffs. There is just simply no time to pull them away and do all this kind of promotions. And there's a lot of competition for the American side. One cannot assume that they're going to make the final.
Well, that's the irony. I mean, there is at least the potential that this World Cup will be a heck of a lot more competitive than the last one was, because you don't talk anymore about just the U.S., China, and Norway as great sides. You include other teams. Am I wrong about this?
No, I think you're absolutely right. Brazil is now a real threat. It took the United States women 93 minutes to get a goal against them in a recent friendly in Houston, and they won 1-0. Canada then turned around and beat Brazil twice. So there's another sleeper. Canada now coached by the former Norwegian coach Pellerud, who's a brilliant coach, maybe the best in the world. They're going to be difficult to beat. Germany are very, very strong.
And they don't even have their best player, because Maren Meyer decided she didn't want to play for the national team anymore.
Exactly. She wants to put her feet up and watch TV, at least the games on TV. So there are many, many good teams. But that is why it's so exciting. The American women should take some pride from the fact that their leadership has led to this, has led to the growth of this game around the world, not as the sole cause, but as a very much of a prime cause for this effect. And it's having an inspirational effect. But I think it does mean that the old cliche of on any given day, when you get to the knockout stages, the quarterfinals, semifinals, the USA is going to have to be at the top of its game.
Veteran soccer broadcaster and commentator Seamus Mallon often joins me to discuss the world game. Thank you, Seamus.
Good to be here again, Bill.
Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan & Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senior citizens dance in Miami's Little Havana. Horns blare in the bombed-out streets of Kosovo. And steel drums ring below Broadway and a New York subway platform. I'm Scott Simon. These sounds of our world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In National League play, the Cincinnati Reds beat the San Francisco Giants 5-3. The Chicago Cubs defeated the Arizona Diamondbacks 4-3. The Montreal Expos doubled up the Milwaukee Brewers 8-4. And the Atlanta Braves edged the Los Angeles Dodgers 2-0. In a hit parade, the Pittsburgh Pirates squeaked by the Colorado Rockies 12-11. The Philadelphia Phillies blanked the San Diego Padres 6-0, and the St. Louis Cardinals routed the New York Mets 8-2, and the Astros bested the Florida Marlins 2-1. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a return to the golfing days when woods were wood. But first, our analyst Charlie Pierce joins me for a discussion of the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
And how much wood could a wood? Never mind.
It's no fun to ask, Charlie, but the NFL teams start playing preseason games today. So, are you ready for some football?
I know I am, Bill, but have you laid in the yearly supplies? Have you parsed out the Patriots change to the 3-4 defense? Are you wondering whether Warren Sapp still has the fire in his not inconsiderable belly to come back to the Super Bowl? I know you've been wrestling with these questions.
The Tampa Bay Buccaneers, defending Super Bowl champions, and the New York Jets open the preseason tonight in Japan. Now, does that mean that people who want to buy regular season tickets for those teams have to buy tickets to the game in Japan and plane tickets to Tokyo as well?
I don't think the NFL cares if they buy the plane tickets as long as they buy the tickets to the game.
I was afraid of that. Quasi-seriously, what questions are you looking for the NFL preseason to answer?
Absolutely none. The only question the NFL preseason ever answers is which team that you think is going to be good is going to get so racked up and injured that they're completely worthless for gambling purposes for the next 4 months.
A couple of weeks ago, we discussed Maurice Claret, the record-breaking Ohio State running back who might be receiving special treatment as a student. A story this week suggested that he was also receiving some expensive audio options, and then I gather the story morphed into something else.
It's very odd. Apparently, Maurice neglected to lock his car, the car, by the way, being a problem in and of itself. And $800 in cash, $5,000 in stereo equipment, 300 CDs, that's a big car, valued at $4,500, and a credit card were stolen from the car.
Or it's so he initially reported,
yes,
at least.
And then he apparently exaggerated the amount of stuff that was removed from the car. The problem Maurice has basically is the car. The license plate is registered to some place called the Car Store, Inc.
Well, that makes a certain amount of sense.
A small dealership on the north side of Columbus. Why didn't he just, like, go next door to the Graft Store, for example, and replace all the stuff that got lifted?
I love college football, pro football, college football, sorry. The NBA season schedule came out this week, Charlie, and much to the surprise of some, including yours truly, the NBA's newest cash cow, LeBron James, will not be available on opening night. What are they thinking?
Well, you obviously didn't get the memo from the league. LeBron doesn't have to play till the first round of the playoffs when the Cavaliers are automatically seeded third. No, look, the opening night of the NBA season is October 28th, and it belongs to the big Aristotle and his boys, who will be playing the Dallas Mavericks. Now, arguably, the Los Angeles Lakers, with all that's going on around them, God knows, are a bigger story than LeBron James. Second of all, do you want to go and tell the big Aristotle he's not the big name in the league anymore? I don't.
No. Okay. In the WNBA, Seattle Storm coach Ann Donovan incurred a $1,000 fine for verbally abusing officials. This would be tip change for an NBA coach, but Donovan said nothing is worth $1,000 afterwards. Obviously, this mattered to her.
Well, there are several things I can think of that are worth $1,000, but they have nothing to do with verbally abusing officials. This is an indication, of course, of the difference between the two leagues, but also an indication that somehow they're getting a little closer. If Ann Donovan, who I always remember as being kind of a placid, disciplined, quiet kind of basketball player, is being outraged at bad officiating, the leagues are getting a lot closer.
The Boston Red Sox proved a new baseball proverb this week, Charlie. You live by the Grand Slam, you die by the Grand Slam. I assume that the elation over Bill Miller's record-setting switch-hit Grand Slams was about as short-lived as you anticipated it would be.
I actually watched the first game. I didn't watch the game on Thursday night where they lost on the walk-off, as they say, Grand Slam to Alex Rodriguez. I thought almost everything you could possibly see in baseball was done, but hitting Grand Slams from both sides of the plate had never been done before.
An admission of sorts came from the Players Union and the Expos this week. They don't much care which city they call home next year as long as it's truly home for all 81 games. This seems a reasonable request.
Major League Baseball, which Lord knows, has enough problems in managing his affairs, has got to get the issue of the Expos solved. The idea of Major League Baseball running a team, especially as you get closer to the trading deadline, as we did this week, where they had prime players and people like Javier Vasquez and Vlad Guerrero, and not being able to trade them because you don't want Major League Baseball to be seen as influencing from the league office.
Absolutely.
So one team against another is a preposterous situation that cannot continue. That having been said, any idea of moving my Expos to Washington, D.C., without first considering my option of Havana, it's got to be dismissed out of hand.
You know how baseball players often wait until they've retired to confess that they used steroids or they scuffed the ball or did something like that? And
yes.
Now the retired superintendent of the Metrodome in Minneapolis has acknowledged that he used to tinker with the ventilation system in order to help the Twins. So should the 87 and 91 World Series have little asterisks beside them in the record book?
This is Dick Erickson is my new sports news hero, because this is just a wonderful story. He says that not only did he actually do this, but that he had the air currents blowing out when Kirby Puckett hit the 11th inning home run to beat the Braves in the sixth game of the 1991 series. But he said the ball was hit hard enough to go out without helping the ventilation system. They actually brought, like, scientific measuring devices into the Metrodome to see if this was possible. The executive director of the Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission in Minneapolis, a guy named Bill Lester, actually put the kibosh on this whole story in a wonderful Minnesotan kind of way by calling the claim, quote, a bunch of hooey.
Charlie, after all the discussion on this program about this summer's Tour de France, we would be remiss if we failed to mention that the injured Tyler Hamilton managed a fourth-place finish, quite extraordinary, and Lance Armstrong won his record-tying fifth consecutive Tour. However, moments after Lance's victory was assured, people immediately began questioning him. Can you win it for a sixth time? Couldn't they let the guy at least take a nap?
Well, I mean, I would hope that if he actually goes out and does it next year, the question will not be, can you win it for a seventh time? Obviously, the question came up this time because he is tied now with Miguel Indurain, which I always – a great name, by the way. I mean, did Miguel win Indurain, do we know?
He won so many. Some were probably Indurain and some were probably
very into sunshine there, right? I think it's sort of a legitimate question since, you know, if he does go past Indurain's record in the sunshine or not.
Whether.
It will be the final huge achievement of a huge career.
Charlie, my favorite record setter of the week is Felix Baumgartner, who jumped out of an airplane and soared across the English Channel. It took him 10 minutes, and I'm wondering if folks are now standing in line for the opportunity to break that one.
First of all, Felix knows one thing. If you make great video, you will get on television. Because this was great video, although I am sort of wondering about some poor old, you know, drunk farmer in Normandy who looks up and there's this huge white bird fly. What? Right, look. Zut alors.
He sort of fell across the
English
Channel.
Well, the problem with one of the problems is that he doesn't have his classical references too good, because the whole thing was called Project Icarus. And as you may recall, Icarus didn't end well. First of all, he got too close to the sun. Second of all, he landed in the ocean. And third, he died.
That's it. I don't know if we'll ever see the image of Vince Lombardi or Joe Montana on our currency, Charlie, but folks in Great Britain recently voted David Beckham the guy that they would most like to see on their banknotes. You like this idea?
Yes, because now not only can we bend it like Beckham, we can fold it like Beckham.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me at this time each week for Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
He's flying man!
Our recent anniversary celebration provoked a call from Dennis Pofelli, who hears the show on WBUR.
And I'm just calling to wish you guys a very happy 10th anniversary and to thank you for your coverage of the 2001 National Blind Chess Championship in Framingham, Massachusetts. Michelle Seaton was the person who did the coverage, and thank you very much for giving some exposure to that event, because it hasn't had it since.
Howard Bennett of Morrisville, Pennsylvania, wrote with this injunction, please do not ever lose Charlie Pierce. His line, nonconformity is okay as long as we all do it at the same time, makes as much sense as anything else going on in FIFA. Another Charlie Pierce fan, Allison Palmer of Allberg, Vermont, who regards our analyst as, quote, witty and insightful, wrote, I have never been interested in sports before. Now, every Saturday morning, I leave half an hour early from the mess, noise, and chaos of my toddler-run home to nurse a cup of coffee and enjoy Only a Game in the peace and quiet of the empty parking lot of my health club. I'm a convert. Please keep up the good work. Meredith Beaton Starr emailed to say, I loved Ken Shulman's piece on the Tour de France. The sound was amazing. Ken is a brilliant reporter, and I always look forward to his stories on Only a Game. Another Tour de France fan, Dr. Douglas Gray, a dentist in York Harbor, Maine, enjoyed my conversation with rider Tyler Hamilton's father a couple of weeks ago. Quote, until you made the unnecessary and disparaging remark about his dentist wringing his hands with joy because Tyler, who grinds his teeth when he's in pain from an injury, quote, may need a few crowns after the tour. I can assure you, wrote Dr. Gray, most dentists do not take pleasure in our patients' misfortune. In fact, if Tyler would make the 50-mile drive from Marblehead, Massachusetts, to York Harbor, Maine, I would wring my hands with joy to meet him and to do his dental work for free. I think you owe the dental profession an apology for propagating the stereotype that dentists are greedy, uncaring opportunists. I'm sorry. Is it safe? Finally, Robert M. Prowler of Pompano Beach, Florida, who hears the show on WRMF in Miami, wrote of my conversation last week with Charlie Pierce, I heard you and Charlie agree that Barry Bonds is most likely the greatest ball player of all time. Of course, your being from Boston might explain your forgetting the Babe. Actually, were I to vote on such things, my vote for the greatest ever would probably go to Willie Mays, and I've got to go back and listen to that tape to see if I agreed with Charlie. That would be weird. Your emails will reach us at onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can also contact us through the website, onlyagame.org, or write us at WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. And you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Today in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, golfers will tee it up at the National Hickory Championship. They'll have to negotiate the historic Oakhurst Links, where the fairways are maintained by sheep, and they'll be using equipment from the turn of the century. Over the last 10 years, there's been a growing interest in playing competitive golf with hickory-shafted clubs. Interlochen Public Radio's Peter Payette reports.
At this year's Hickory Open at Michigan's Kingsley Golf Course, players wore ties and baggy knickers, known as plus fours because the pant leg tucks into the sock about 4 inches below the knee. There were no spectators other than caddies and other golfers playing in the tournament. Casual observers might not have noticed there was a tournament going on. The winner, Fred Muller, finished his second round in the rain with a 76 and took home the crystal vase. Fred Muller's been the club pro for 25 years at Frankfort, Michigan's Crystal Downs Country Club, a links-style course designed by Alistair McKenzie and built by his associate Perry Maxwell in 1929. Laid out on a bluff between Lake Michigan and the smaller Crystal Lake, the Downs' deep, unmowed roughs, windy fairways, and natural terrain discourage low scores, making it perfect for hickory golf. Muller frequently plays this course and others with hickory-shafted clubs that were just about to be replaced with metal ones when McKenzie conceived the course.
People are afraid to use them because they think somehow they think it'll hurt their regular game. Well, their regular games are often not that good to start with, but it certainly hasn't hurt my regular game. It's helped. I've learned to swing the club instead of hit at the ball. And plus, I've had so much fun creating shots that you have to do with the old clubs. The modern clubs kind of do everything for you, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Muller says improved equipment has changed conventional golf. He says today it's all about distance, and architects are designing longer courses. He thinks something's been lost.
Golf is not as good a game today as it was 60, 70 years ago. The courses are too well maintained, and we want them too well maintained, which is a mistake. The equipment is way too forgiving, and we are asked to hit only a couple kinds of shots. We can score better scores, but the game itself is not as good, I don't think.
Like many golfers, Muller was introduced to hickory golf by Ralph Livingston. Livingston is a photographer who lives in Grand Rapids. Back in the early 90s, he became interested in building and repairing clubs. He says what turned him on about the hickories was the great variety of clubs that were made in the early 20th century, and the challenge of figuring out what each club was meant to do.
They were so experimental back then. And some of these oddball utility clubs are just a
blast to get out and hit and see what the heck they were designed for. I mean, after you play these things for a while, you start looking at the weighting and look at the loft and look at the shaft length, and you can get a pretty good guesstimation of what the intent of the use of the club was.
Livingston is the driving force behind Hickory Golf. His website, hickorygolf.com, is a hub of information about vintage equipment. Although Livingston claims he's not a collector, many Hickory golfers are. Roger Hill is a golfer from Grand Rapids and a friend of Livingston's.
There's a golf collectors society worldwide, one in the United States, one in the U.K. And the United States organization, and I guess the U.K. organization, are collector-based. And when they played, they'd have a get-together and they'd grab a few clubs and go out and play, and they'd call it a hacker. We don't like that term. We play very seriously. We all work very hard on our clubs. Our clubs are worth a lot of money, and we search, you know, far and wide to try and find the correct clubs to fit our set.
Dallas attorney and golfer John Crow Miller sits with Randy Jensen in the Kingsley Clubhouse after the Hickory Open. Jensen finished third at the Open. He's won a number of Hickory tournaments over the years and runs a retail golf shop in Omaha, Nebraska. Crow Miller sees Hickory golf as countercultural, almost subversive.
Randy's a great example. He can break par with hickory shafted golf clubs, and I think the equipment manufacturers would probably not be very interested in knowing that people can use 80-year-old golf equipment and make good scores on their cart.
Yeah, I mean, the manufacturers have come to a point where people feel like they cannot hit a club that's 20 years old because it doesn't have any sweet spot or something like that.
How about two years old?
2 years old, maybe. Yeah, and I've played rounds of golf where I outdrive somebody who's got a brand-new titanium Callaway, and all of a sudden it's like, man, their whole world just got turned upside down. And it's pretty funny to see that happen. But, I mean, it's mind-altering for them because that's almost inconceivable that you could take a club 80 years old and hit it that well.
Jensen says he plays about a dozen of about 20 competitive tournaments each year, including some in Europe. He'll play for the American team in September when Hickory Golf's equivalent of the Ryder Cup is played in the U.S. for the first time. At least 12 Americans will compete against a British team at the Hickory Grail at St. Andrews Golf Club in New York. For Only a Game, I'm Peter Payette in Kingsley, Michigan.
Golfers who, when you've been round the sand, when your scores you recall. For I've played for a year, and as sure as I'm here, I've never got round them at all. I've never got round them at all.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Mike Garth. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. In our final word this week, Dan Duquette, starring in Damn Yankees, brings down the house.
I'll tell you something right now. My players don't play dead for the Yankees or any other ball club.
Great, great.
Oh, sorry. That line wasn't supposed to be funny. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Just take your tongue from your cheek, caddy. Your wicked thoughts, I guess. Is it mashy or is it cleek, caddy, that gets me best out of this mess? For every stroke that I make, caddy, is driving me deeper in. Advise me for goodness sake, caddy, and don't stand there and grin.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.